Tonight is the Book of Ecclesiastes. Of course, tonight isn't enough time to really do the book in any comprehensive way, but I'd like to at least give an overview of some of the main points concerning the writings of Ecclesiastes. There are several points that we could, several headings, topics that we could use, which would be applicable to Ecclesiastes. Let me just try to give an introduction to the book. Essentially, let me just first say what the book is about. What is the nature? What is the writing about? The writing of the book concerns human life, and essentially what Ecclesiastes does is he shows that every lifestyle imaginable is basically fantasy, and since it's fantasy, it's frustrating. Now, he uses two terms in the book. One is hevel in Hebrew, which means it means like air, like something which is nothing really. And the other term he uses is ru'us ruach. That means modern terms that would be frustration. So he shows that things are empty and also that they're frustrating. And what he does is he goes through every single lifestyle and he shows why each lifestyle is frustrating. Amazing is the scope of the book. And the lifestyles that he goes through covers just about every type of life that a person could lead. I mean, there's a lot of mixtures, but he hits the major ones. And that's really the substance of the book. Many people get depressed when they read Ecclesiastes. It sounds depressing. Well, he does say that the heart of the wise man is in the house of mourning, and the fool is in the house of, is in the house of rejoicing. So Ecclesiastes would say that if you get depressed from the truth, then maybe you're better off with depression. At least you'll be in line with reality. But a person who evades reality must pay the price. I'm just giving you that would be heading one. What is the book about? This is just a general. General statement. We'll come back to it more. There are other points that perhaps would be more important as a point of departure, a starting point concerning the book of Ecclesiastes. One would be his methodology. What is the methodology that he uses in...
Rabbi? Yeah. Gary Buchanan said that he would like for you to give an example of those two words that you began with in English in the text so we could see kind of how they were used.
Okay, hold on. Could, just give me a second, all
right? Okay, all right. All right, thank you.
Okay, the words in the text. Let's take the very first verse, okay? The second verse, I mean. Ecclesiastes 1, 2, all right? Now, here he says, the first one, that's havel. Now, I don't know what your translation is. It probably is vanity, emptiness. Yeah, vanity, is not really a good word. That's not a precise, doesn't carry a precise meaning. The translation is usually the literary style is a greater concern than giving you an accurate meaning of the word. But the word havel, havola, means an emptiness of emptinesses, says Ecclesiastes, okay? That's the word emptiness. And we'll explain what he means by an emptiness of emptinesses. But there's the word, okay? Now, he constantly repeats that term. Like when he comes to something, he immediately says that this is emptiness. All right? Take a look, 14, all right? And 14, he says, I saw all the things that were done under the sun, and behold, everything is emptiness. That's that word, hevel, again. And the next word is frustration, ru'us ruach. That means that life is frustrating. Life is empty. Life is frustrating. And he shows, and then he proceeds to go through the various lifestyles, showing that each one leads to nothing more than emptiness and frustration. Okay? If you'd like, I'll give you an example of that. Take a look at two. All right? Take a look at two. So in two, he states that he says that he says, and I said in my heart that I will engage in happiness and see good, which means to say that he's going to enjoy himself, partake of the lifestyle of enjoyment. And then he says, and behold, that too is emptiness. And now he explains why. He says because play, which is like enjoyment, I said is simply the word over there that he uses is maholo. It's interpreted as meaning something which leads a person to depression. Okay, and the next thing he says is, and happiness, I said simcha, meaning partaking. Simcha means like a happy, joyous occasion. And joyousness and happiness, I said, what does it do? Okay. Now, you always must, the Ecclesiastes, and the same thing is true of all the Torah, demands a certain two things. A person has to have a certain level of intelligence, but a person must also know how to interpret the written word. If you aren't trained in the method of interpretation, your chances are very slim of really uncovering the ideas. Now, let me just take this one, just give an example. What is he saying here? I mean, you know, a person can just say anything is nothing. What is the proof? Well, what he's saying is as follows. His premise is that it's based upon his psychological understanding of man. And there's another word here which is extremely important, and that is the word in verse 1, verse 3. Where he says, what, Yisron is the word in Hebrew. How do they translate that? Okay, they say prophet. The word Yisron, the problem is always with just translations. The word Yisron comes from the word Yoser, which means more. Okay, more. Meaning to say, what, I'll explain to you why, what exactly it means. But let's just get that idea, something more. What extra, what more is there for man with all the toil that he toils under the sun? What does he mean by the statement? You see, the wise king Solomon is giving us something here in the statement. He's teaching us something. What he's teaching us is that man, the psychological makeup of man, is that a person is always looking for something that is extra, special, more. A person doesn't want to live just an ordinary, drab existence. Not happy with that. Every person wants to feel they're special. They're doing something extra. A person is looking for something which makes him feel important, makes his life feel like he's doing something fantastic. Whether the person is the head of a business, whether he's a CEO, whether he's a religious leader, it makes no difference what he's doing. Whatever a person does, he strives for one thing. He strives for that sense of importance, that feeling of being someone that's special, that extra feeling, that good feeling. And that's what Ecclesiastes' understanding of human psychology is, that a person cannot be happy just thinking to himself, what am I? I am what does Aristotle say? Man is a rational animal, and this is an I, you know, just I exist, I eat, I sleep, I may think, whatever, and this is my life. A person will not be happy that way. Human psychology is such that man is looking for something extra in life. Okay, that's a premise of his understanding of human psychology. Now, okay. Now, premising that, you see, that's why these two opening verses are very important. When he says everything is empty, and then he says what gain is there, or what extra is there for man, so what he's trying to show is that man is looking for that something in life that makes him feel important, superior in a way, not necessarily in a bad way, in a good way, something special about himself, and he's looking for accomplishment. Accomplishment would fit in perfectly with Ecclesiastes' concept of the Yisroel, the word accomplishment. You say, well, what does a person want in life? A person wants to accomplish something, wants to do something. What does it mean, do something? Why don't you just, what does an animal do? It eats, it sleeps, and it enjoys the instinctual life, and that's it. Can a person just say, look, that's all I am, okay? And I'm just going to enjoy life physically, instinctually, intellectually, that's it. So King Solomon says, no, that's impossible from a psychological standpoint for a human being to do that. And now, once he premises that, then he goes to show the various lifestyles that try to achieve that extra, that special kind of sense of satisfaction, that sense of accomplishment that I did something, and he shows every single one fails. Okay? By the way, this idea that a person is looking for something extra in life was also mentioned by the philosopher Bertrand Russell. All right? He says that... And I'm quoting Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell, as you know, was an agnostic. He was not a religious philosopher at all, but a very intelligent person, a brilliant mathematician and physicist, I mean, a philosopher, a historian. He was a man of many, many different talents and superb minds. But he wasn't agnostic. He was not religious. Now, he says as follows. He says, the world has need of a philosophy or a religion which will promote life. All right? He says, but in order to promote life, it is necessary to value something other than mere life. In other words, you can't just say, well, I'm just living. That's it. I live 70 years, eat, sleep, enjoy my instinctual life, and then I die. A person can't do that. Mere life, a person isn't happy with. He says, life devoted only to life is animal, without any real human value, incapable of preserving men permanently from weariness and the feeling that all is vanity. I wouldn't be surprised if he... gleaned this from Ecclesiastes. It sounds right out of Ecclesiastes. And he was well read, and I'm sure he read the Bible. He says, if life is to be fully human, it must serve some end which seems in some sense outside human life, some end which is impersonal and above mankind, such as God or truth or beauty. All right? So he says, those who best promote life do not have life for their purpose. They aim what seems like a gradual... incarnation, a bringing into our human existence something eternal, something that appears to the imagination to live in a heaven remote from strife and failure and the devouring jaws of time. This is Ecclesiastes, basically. It's an amazing thing, but that's what he's saying. And Ecclesiastes' theme is based on that. The fact that man is looking for that something special, call it eternal, infinite, whatever it is, but he's trying to link up to something very important. Okay? And therefore, he says, since man has that drive, now the question is, given that drive, and this is his dilemma, that's the nature of man, how does man fulfill that drive? Can he satisfy it or not? Ecclesiastes gives a very devastating answer. He says, no, he can't. And he shows each time why that is the case. And what you have to do is you have to be able to understand the method of analysis of the biblical text in order to be able to see how he's telling you that it fails. Okay? Let me just take this one case that we mentioned before. All right? Now he says here, he tried to engage in enjoyment, happiness, rejoicing. That seems like a wonderful thing to do. What does a person want in life? They try to have parties. Each man tries to be happy, tries to enjoy himself. So he says, what's wrong with that? That's where he says in 2:1, he says he's going to engage in it. In 2:2, he shows you what's wrong with it. What's wrong with it? He says two things. It's devastating, and what does it do? What does it do? What does it mean when he says, and to rejoicing, I said, what does it do? What does that mean? You have to think into the words of the man. After all, this is King Solomon, the wisest of men. When he says something, you have to think about it. Now, what is he saying when he says, and to rejoicing, what does it do? What does he mean to say? He's saying very simply, when a person rejoices, after he gets finished rejoicing, he finds he's in depression. Why? Because he thinks to himself, what did I accomplish? What does it do? What did I accomplish? Nothing. So man looks to be happy, tries to rejoice, wants to enjoy life, but he finds when he rejoices, the party has to be over. And when the party's over, he thinks back, what did I accomplish last night? Nothing. And a part of man, an intrinsic part of man, is that need to feel a sense of accomplishment. You see, the playboy kind of life tries to deny that. Tries to deny that truth. Tries to say, well, I'm just going to have fun. Just going to enjoy life. That's the lifestyle of the playboy. But the playboy life can never be satisfying because there's something in man that is looking for this feeling of accomplishment and being something special. You see, more than just an animal. And man looks for it in various fields. He looks for it in business, to become a great businessman, an empire builder. That's going to make him feel he's something very special. Or he may look for it in knowledge. He may look for it in religion. Every area is open for that kind of a pursuit. He may look for it in physics. He may look for it in science and mathematics. Every area basically is open for that kind of a possibility. And this is what this is the nature of this. I'm just giving you the essential idea of the book. The essential idea of the book is to show that there is not a single lifestyle that can really satisfy that need in man, which on the surface sounds devastating, and it sounds like there is human happiness is just a hopeless goal. Don't even try. Okay, we'll get to that later. Is there a solution to the problem? Okay, I'm just telling you the answer. I don't want anybody to get too depressed. The answer is there is, but it's very, very difficult and very, very rare. Okay. Now, let me just. Let me just give one. One more example of a lifestyle that he shows doesn't work. This one's one. The first one I gave was the lifestyle of basically the Hollywood lifestyle, the partying lifestyle. Partying lifestyle leads to depression because the fact that it doesn't satisfy man's inner need for accomplishment. But what about, let's take the religious lifestyle. What is it all about that? What about the monk, the person that tries to escape the world and just cloaks himself with a certain feeling of religiosity, feels very holy, the holy emotion. That certainly is a lifestyle. Okay, that's something that we're all familiar with. The religious man, the man that tries to walk around feeling holy and special. That's his method, by the way, of accomplishing what Ecclesiastes is saying. Except he's trying to do it through the religious sphere. He's really no different in his attempt than a person that's doing it through any other way. When you look at it from a psychological standpoint, okay? Now, take a look. He takes that up in 7:16, all right? There he says, do not be too righteous. Okay, and then he says, do not be too righteous. I'm jumping to the end of the verse because he says, why should you become desolate? Okay, so there when he says do not be too righteous, there he's speaking about the righteous lifestyle, where he's saying a person who devotes himself to righteousness, to being a monk, in other words, removing yourself from society and just walking around all day. And not eating much, and restrictions, and keeping away from other people, being alone, and just engaging in religious devotion. He says, if you do that, what happens? You become desolate. Why? What's the reason for desolation? The reason is, again, when you look at human nature, you will see that any person that does that is merely suppressing the other side of his nature. And what happens is that there's a backlash from the other side. The other side, you can't just take a human being and do anything you want with them. That's the mistake that most people make. They feel that they could do anything because suddenly they feel that, okay, I'm going to become a religious person now. That's very nice for an hour. Very nice. But then what happens is, after a while, the other side of their nature, the instinctual side, is starts demanding, making demands on the person, which the person is not satisfying. Then when a person is in a state where the demands are made upon them, their psyche is making demands on them they can't satisfy, they become depressed and desolate. That's what he says about the religious lifestyle. So I'm just giving an example of, you know, just two of them. There are many of them that he has in the book. You have to be able to, you have to be able to seek them out, I mean, to find them, but they are there. So we'll come back to that. That's just, as I said, you know, we have to approach this in a multidimensional way. This is one aspect, all right? The next point I said that we should discuss is his methodology in teaching you something. And you'll find that he has an interesting methodology, okay? His methodology, just to give you an example, and you'll have to pardon me, but really, you know, I didn't take time to jot down a lot of these verses, okay? So it'll take me a second to find it. Let's take, for instance, the case, let's take a, just give me one second. Okay. Let's take a look at Ecclesiastes 1, verse 18. Okay? Take a look at that one for a second. All right? Ecclesiastes 1, verse 18. Last verse. Now, over there, what does he say? He says that with more knowledge, one has more anger. Okay? So, knowledge, he says in several places, that knowledge is a very wonderful thing. Even though he seems to say in other places, it's not. There's another contradiction. But he says a wonderful thing. So, it would seem that anger is a good thing. All right? Then take a look, for instance, at 7:3. Again, he says, anger is better than rejoicing. Okay? It would seem to be that anger is good. Then he says, however, he says in another place, and I'll show it to you in a second, he says that you must remove anger from your heart, because anger is something which resides in the bosom of a fool. Okay? That verse, excuse me, hold on one second. That's okay, I got it. It's 11:10. Pardon me for that. 11:10. He says, remove anger from your heart. He says, and you will be, and remove an evil from your flesh. Because youth is emptiness. Again, that word, hevel, that's the same word, keeps on recurring. All right? So here you have a contradiction. Over here he says, remove anger from your heart, and he also says, and remove an evil from your flesh. Now, that seems to be a pretty bad thing. On the other hand, over here he says, in 1:18, because with much knowledge is much anger. That seems to be anger is a good thing. And then again, where I showed you before, in chapter 7, he says, 7:3, he says, anger is better than rejoicing. Alright? That seems to be, he's promoting it. He thinks it's a good thing. Now you see a contradiction. Now, throughout Ecclesiastes, there are contradictions. Now, the wise king, a wise person doesn't contradict, an ordinary person that's intelligent doesn't, or at least superficially doesn't contradict themselves, or doesn't try to contradict themselves. Now here we're talking about King Solomon, the wisest of men, and we see the book is laden with contradictions. So, as a matter of fact, the Talmud says, and we'll get to this piece of Talmud, interesting piece of Talmud, the Talmud says that they really wanted to take the book of Ecclesiastes out of circulation. They wanted to place it into Geniza. I'll explain to you, I'll explain to you what that means. It says, why did they want to do that? Because they said his words contradict each other. Contradictory. Okay. I'll explain to you what, but they didn't do it. And I'll tell you why. We'll take up that piece of Talmud. As usual, the Talmud really gives us the greatest insight and really gets to the core of something. And that statement itself is, the fact that they mention the contradictions is very important because that's at the heart of his book. Now, why are there so many contradictions in the book? The answer is very simple. The reason why he wrote in that manner is because in Jewish philosophy is different. Torah philosophy, I should say, is different than other philosophies. Because other philosophies or other philosophers, their concern is simply to express their ideas. That's the only concern they have. So they try to express their ideas as clearly as possible. But Torah has a problem with that. Because Torah maintains that ideas are very good for a person that's on the level. But a person that's not on the level, ideas can be harmful. And that's why the wise people always wrote in a mushal, in a parable form. You see, in the beginning of Proverbs, to understand the parables and the riddles of the wise. Why in riddles? Because they wish to protect the ignorant from misunderstanding their words. And if you take a look at Ecclesiastes, right at the end, he says the exact same statement. It says that when it speaks about Ecclesiastes, it says that in 12:9, and not only was Ecclesiastes a wise man, he taught the people. And he says in the end of the verse, it says he formulated many parables. Okay. So the parable, and we'll see the parables that are in Ecclesiastes, what exactly it means. But the parable is there because the Torah philosopher is not ready to just give away his knowledge. He's not interested in showing how much he knows. That's an arrogant concept. That's an ego idea. And the only thing he's interested in doing is conveying Torah to the right people to improve them. So he has to be very cautious. That's why the prophet says also that the words, the lips of the priest guard the knowledge. That means they don't just give it out. You have to know who and when you're giving out the knowledge to. Sometimes it can be very harmful if you give something to someone they're not ready for. That's why the parable, and that's why the Medrash, that's why people today, unfortunately, Medrash was never meant to be written down, and wasn't meant to be taught to the masses, just to the scholars. And it's written in parables. And they see when the masses get a hold of it, they misinterpret it, and they come up with the most inane ideas, which are very harmful. So over here, we have to realize that the methodology, here you have an example of the methodology of the wise king. The methodology was contradiction. Because the average person, when he looks at it, is going to see, well, it's a contradiction. I don't understand what this is. So he's going to walk away confused. And that's, he's just going to say to himself, well, I guess I don't understand what Ecclesiastes is talking about. And that's not bad. So if a person is ignorant, not to understand something is not bad, as long as he knows he doesn't understand it. But on the other hand, an intelligent person will immediately see that, just a moment, what is going on here? He's trying to tell me something. This can't be a real contradiction. This is superficially as a contradiction, but there must be an idea here. So for the intelligent person, it's a guiding light to look down beneath the surface. Okay? Let's take this one. I'll just show you how this one works. Over here he says that with much knowledge, there's much anger. Okay? And then he says later again, he says, remove anger from your heart and you will be removing an evil from your flesh. Okay? Now what does he mean in those verses? What we have to look for here is the generic definition of anger. What does anger mean? There must be one definition of anger, and then there is a subdivision. One anger he's discussing in Ecclesiastes 1, another anger he's discussing in Ecclesiastes, excuse me, that was, what is that, 9, I think. Okay, yeah, the other anger he's talking about is in Ecclesiastes 11:10. So we have 11:10, and we have 1:18. Now, we must look for the universal definition of anger and then find out what the subdivision is. There's a subdivision here. That's clear. So a person that knows how to think, who's been trained in the method of analysis of the Talmud, knows immediately how to approach this. The way you approach it is, you have two things, there's a contradiction. The solution to the contradiction is very simple. There's one heading, and then there is a subdivision. And once you have a subdivision, there's no contradiction because they're two different things. Now, let's just apply that method, and you'll see how it works. Let's understand what anger is. That's the first step. Anger, when does a person get angry? Let's take a common situation where a person gets angry. Why is he angry? A person is angry because reality doesn't correspond to his or her wishes. That's what anger is. Anger is when a person, why does a person get angry? Frustrated, angry. A person gets angry because things aren't going his way or her way. That causes anger. So the average person gets quite angry often. Doesn't always have to express it, but you can be angry inside also. But the reason for the anger is things aren't going their way. Something goes wrong. There's no need to enumerate. I mean, every one of us knows there are innumerable situations in life where things go against us, against our wishes. Against your wishes, people get angry. So there, King Sol, that kind of anger is what he's discussing in 11... in 11:10, all right? There he says, this is very bad. He says, remove anger from your heart, and you'll be removing an evil from your flesh. Now, what he means is as follows, two things. He means that a person that gets angry, for any reason whatsoever, is really a fool. And that's why he says, he mentions another place, because anger resides in the bosom of fools. Why? Because a person who is a fool always looks, is myopic, always looks, he focuses on one event. And he looks at it and says, why did this happen this way? This could have happened another way. It could have happened exactly the way I'd like it to happen. Okay? That's a fool. A wise person looks at the entire scheme of things. And if you look at the scheme of things, you'll see that things cannot, if you understand how things work, you can have a number of things. If you're intelligent, you have a higher number of things that are in your favor. If you're less intelligent, more, because you're not really doing anything with reality. But even an intelligent person who makes the right moves is going to have to find that things do not go his way because of the fact that there's a reality out there, and reality is guided by certain causes, and these causes aren't always in your favor. Okay? So therefore, once a person understands that, he will never get angry. There's no reason to ever get angry. If something goes against your wishes, all this means is you should study the situation logically and then see what can be done to make it more favorable. Now, either you can do something to make it more favorable, then you do it, and if you cannot, then you must accept reality. A fool doesn't accept reality. A fool doesn't realize that there's a time when this is the way reality is, and that's it. A fool always thinks they can do anything. In today's society, what do we teach people? What do we teach children? What do we teach adults? We always say, you can do anything. That's the philosophy. That's the American philosophy. Okay? That is a very silly, unrealistic philosophy. That philosophy causes what King Solomon calls anger. Okay? Because if a person thinks, a person is taught that they can do anything, then when things don't go their way, so then they think it's something which is a sign of their own inability. They get very frustrated, very angry. But if a person is taught you cannot do everything, there are certain things you can do, certain things you cannot do, and what you cannot do, you must accept. When you cannot do something, you must accept reality. That is a wise person. So therefore, he says, anger resides in the bosom of fools, because a fool thinks he could change reality when he can't, and a fool is an individual who just expects reality to correspond to his wishes, and therefore he experiences anger. But a wise person would never. That's why he says. Now he says, remove anger from your heart. He says, he gives you advice, and then he says, and you'll take away an evil from your flesh. What does he mean by the evil from your flesh? Here you have another theory of Ecclesiastes, and that's one which I think today most of the medical profession would agree with, and that is that when a person is upset internally, is psychologically upset, this is going to affect his physical health as well. Maimonides writes that way, and Maimonides was very big on that, and today they're starting to agree with that. They studied people that live to be very old age and haven't found that they do aerobics them, they even smoke, and they eat things that they consider to be improper from a health standpoint. But the only thing they have found among those people is they have a certain attitude, which is very positive, and it is a psychologically healthy attitude. So there he says, this is what Ecclesiastes says, the one thing that is extremely unhealthy is anger. Because anger means you can't accept reality, and you're constantly battling reality. That stress of that battle is what destroys the flesh. It destroys you physically as well as psychologically. So that's why he mentions those two points. Now let's get back to the other Ecclesiastes. In 1, the last verse, in 1, there he says, the more intelligent you are, the more angry you are. We just said that that's the most stupid thing to do, is to be angry. It means you can't accept reality. Okay. Over here, he's talking about a different kind of anger. The kind of anger he's talking about over here is, it shares a common thing with the other anger, but it's quite different. And that is the philosophical anger. See, philosophical anger is different. Philosophical anger is when a person recognizes a certain truth that intrinsically goes against what the nature of man is. That's a different kind of an anger. That's an anger that stems from knowledge. Over here, he's saying something different. Here, he's telling you that when you analyze, as we mentioned before, when you analyze human life, what a human being needs, and what the various lifestyles offer him, you'll find out that all they offer him is emptiness and frustration. So there, when he's speaking about anger, he means the philosophical knowledge that reality doesn't conform to, in general, to what man in general is searching for. Okay? There again, it's the same definition of anger in the sense that anger is when reality doesn't conform, but there are two types of not conforming. One is on a personal level where I experience a frustration. The other one is when I look at the world and I analyze man. That's a philosophical. That's not personal. That's philosophical anger. If I study the world and I see that things just don't work out, I'm intelligent enough to see that these lifestyles are not giving you what they are cracked up to give you. When you recognize that, that's a different kind of an anger. That's an anger that's based upon knowledge. There he says that is very intelligent, because the unintelligent person is the one who is duped into thinking that this lifestyle is going to give him the satisfaction. And he or she will spend years and years trying to attain that elusive satisfaction and think that they will gain happiness, but they will never gain happiness. And the reason is, because they're always looking, again, the fool always looks at a segment of reality, the small picture. They're looking at the small picture. Every time they tried something, it didn't work, they say, well, that didn't work for this reason. Let me try again. They keep on trying again, again, again. In the end, they fail, and they face the fact that their life was really a total waste. But if they were intelligent, they'd be able to analyze the big picture, the broad picture, and then they would see that intrinsically this can't work. Okay? If I think to myself that what's going to make me happy is a new home, a new car, an increase in salary. But then if I think to myself, 1 second, didn't I once get a new home? I felt the same way before, but that didn't last too long. Didn't I get a new car? Well, that didn't last too long. I got a raise. How come that didn't make me happy? If a person just looks at the small picture, they will simply every time, just all they could do is be involved in the immediate. But a person that analyzes and thinks, they will see, 1 second, if that didn't work before, why should it work now? There's something wrong here. This is just not going to work. I'm just directing myself in the wrong path. So that he calls a wise person, a person who can look at the big picture of reality and study philosophy honestly, even though it goes against what that person desires life to be. That anger is an anger that results from knowledge. He says the fool won't have such kind of an anger. Of course, the fool is only evolved in each step fully at the time and can't pick his head out above that little step. So he doesn't, all he sees is that little step. So he just keeps trying, he fails, keeps trying. But the wise man looks at the whole picture. He says, just a second, this is failing, not because of the details in this case. It just can't work. There's something wrong here. And then he sees that it does not work. Then he has a philosophical anger. Okay? This is what, that's the answer to the contradiction. There are two types of anger. There's philosophical anger and there's personal private anger. If a person gets angry at his spouse because the spouse didn't give them didn't prepare dinner properly, that's a personal anger, and that's a small-minded, foolish individual, a person who is just has not learned either to try to improve the situation or accept reality. There's no room for anger in human life. Personal anger there's no room for. Only a fool experiences that. A wise man never, by the way, you know, the Talmud and Maimonides discuss various virtues, and a lot of emotions are applicable in various times. Sometimes you have to be haughty, you have to be tough. Sometimes you can't. Okay? And various emotions, the Talmud and the Torah never really tells you to ban any emotion. It says, you know, you have to know when. Sometimes you have to be aggressive. Sometimes you have to be passive. Depends what it is. It always depends on the situation based upon your intellect and your understanding. But when it comes to anger, everybody says there's no place ever for anger. Anyone that ever gets angry, as a matter of fact, the Talmud says that a person who gets angry, it's as if he has served, idols. Why is it like serving idols? Because the purpose of idolatry is to try to control reality. Why did the idolater bring his offerings to his god? To propitiate the gods in order to get the gods to respond to his wishes. It's a wish fulfillment. I just saw on television about 2 weeks ago, they had these, I think it was these Indians, they had this god that they were claimed was drinking milk. Okay? You know, it's an illusion, but they really believed it and they were bringing milk to this god. So they interviewed some of the people that were doing this, filing by, bringing the milk, and they said, well, why are you doing this? So they said, well, we believe if the god consumes the milk, then he'll give us all our wishes. Okay? But that's what idolatry is. Idolatry is an attempt to use the gods to give them to fulfill their wishes. The same thing is true of a person who gets angry, because a person who gets angry cannot accept God's reality. He feels that he wants his wish to overcome reality. That's idolatry. That's what Thomas pointed out. But there is never any room for a person to get angry. If a person gets angry, you know right away he's doing something evil. There's nothing to question. That's it. The only thing the Talmud says that a person can do, Maimonides, is a person can mock anger. Sometimes a person has to appear angry. For instance, a great individual, a leader, sometimes has to appear angry in order to cause people to come to their senses if they are doing something which is wrong. That's something else. Okay. But to be angry, to get angry, is never right. Okay. But that's personal anger. But philosophical anger is very good. It shows intelligence. It shows you looking at the whole picture and you see there's a problem here. That brings out a certain attitude towards reality which shows reality is not in conformity with man's wishes. That's not a personal, that's a philosophical anger. Philosophical anger is good. The Torah differentiates many times between a philosophical emotion, okay, it's not really an emotion, I'm just using that term, and a personal one. For instance, one is not permitted to hate. Hate is considered to be an evil emotion. Yet, philosophical hatred, the Torah insists on. For instance, the hatred against Amalek, and that's a commandment. One is supposed to hate Amalek. That's written openly in the Bible. Why? Because the hatred of Amalek is not a personal hatred. It's not that you hate your friend because he may have slighted you. That's a personal hatred. But the hatred of Amalek is a philosophical hatred. It means you must, if you love mankind, you must hate that which destroys mankind, and that's the false ideas of Amalek. So philosophical hatred is something the Torah promotes. Personal hatred, the Torah considers to be an evil. So you have this differentiation in other cases also. All right? Now, let me just get to the basic question that I think is probably the most important question about Koheleth, and that is the first thing I mentioned was lifestyles. Second thing is his method is through contradiction, and we'll come back to it. I just want to give the basic headings. But the third thing I wanted to mention, which I think is perhaps the most important thing, and that is the question of why do we need a philosophy altogether? What is King Solomon doing here? Does King Solomon believe in God? Does he believe in the Torah? If he does, then there's no reason to philosophize. What do we have to study all this for? What did he write all this for? The Torah is very simple. He believes God exists. He believes the Torah is true. Just do what the Torah says, and that's it. Okay? What do we need to philosophize about? What purpose is there in philosophizing? As a matter of fact, I would say that philosophizing is a little bit of an apostasy. Why? Because don't you believe God knows better than you do? Well, obviously. So he told you what to do, so what are you going to think about? There's nothing to think about. Okay? So that question, as a matter of fact, which would seem to remove the entire need for an Ecclesiastes, all right? Not only is that a question from a logical standpoint, he himself mentions it. If you take a look at Ecclesiastes 12:13, what does he say? He says the end of the thing is, or the conclusion is, I try to be literal. The conclusion is that everything has been heard, meaning to say, I heard all the arguments already. But he says, what do we do? He says, God, you should fear his and his commandments. You should keep, because this is all of man. All right. So what is he saying? He's saying basically that we have all the questions, we heard all these points, but the bottom line is fear God and keep his commandments. Well, I mean, if that's the case, why bother with 12 chapters? I mean, actually, he didn't have chapters. That's a Christian thing. But it's a very long, it's a long Megillah, okay? It's a big Megillah. And what's the need for this Megillah, for this book, for this writing? He himself says the final word is, you heard it, you heard all the questions, but the fact is, you fear God and do his commandments. We could have done that before he started, and he wouldn't have to write all this, and we wouldn't have to study all this. Okay? That is really the most important. If we don't understand that, the answer to that question, then you really can't even begin to read Ecclesiastes, because you wouldn't understand the basis for it. And the truth of the matter is that most, probably all, religions really do believe that. That's why they don't encourage any kind of philosophical investigation. On the contrary, you have your catechisms, you state what you believe in, and that's it. There's no need to go any further. The religions believe their God knows what is best, and once we have that, once we have that catechism, once we have that instruction, we just do it. Okay? Now, King Solomon is deviating from that principle. On the contrary, he's writing all these things and he's analyzing all these lifestyles. That sounds like a philosopher or someone, a psychologist or both. I mean, what is this? I mean, you have the Word of God. What do you need all this for? Okay? That is a question that a religious person would ask. Okay. Now, the answer to that question, let me just answer that question. I think we'll, okay. Yeah, because the answer to that question is, really found, and as I always say, everything goes back to Torah. Without Torah, the five books, you don't have anything. And anything that's written anywhere is always an extension of those five books. The five books, the five books of the Torah are the absolute Word of God. And the prophets are really different than the five books. I want to get back to that also, from the Talmudic statement. They're different. It's important to understand how they're different, but you cannot put them in the same class, okay? For instance, the Talmud says they wished to take the book of Ecclesiastes and, well, they say, not ban it, but to place it in Geniza, which means that it will be removed from circulation. I'll explain what that means. But, okay, in other words, descriptively we'll use the word ban, but we're using it descriptively. It's not really the same thing. It's a special halachic process. But they wish to ban the book of Ecclesiastes. Now the question is, how can you do such a thing? Isn't that the written word? Isn't it in the Bible? You can't ban the book of Deuteronomy, okay? And obviously you can't. And the reason is because the five books of Moses are the only thing that we have from God through Moses. Everything else is written in a totally different framework. I'll explain what that framework is. And it's not a question of what is true or what is not true. That's not the question, okay? If a prophet says something, it's obviously true. But that does not place it on a par in any way with the Word of God, the five books of Moses. And we'll get back to that. That's another aspect of what I'd like to I'd like to take up, because I think it's another important topic. Okay, but right now that would be topic four. But right now I'm in the third topic, and that is the question of what is the, how could you have philosophy? What's the need for philosophy? And what right do we have even to philosophize? Okay. Now here I mentioned that we must go back to the book, the Torah, the book of Exodus. All right. And here we have, in Exodus, we have, again, a contradiction. All right? Contradictions are good because they make you think. There's no real contradiction. It just appears like a contradiction. If you're intelligent, you sense there's something here. Now, take a look, for instance, at Exodus 14:31. There it says, and Israel saw the great hand which God performed in Egypt, and the nation feared God, and they believed in God, and his servant Moses. Okay? So that would seem to be, that happened after the splitting of the sea. Right? Alright, that's one. Now here's another verse. Later, that was in 14. Now we go to 19. In 19:9, it says, God said to Moses, behold, I am coming to you in the thickness of a cloud. Why? That was Sinai. Why? In order that the people should hear when I speak with you, and also in you will they believe forever. Which means they will believe that Moses is God's servant, truly. Okay, now the question is just a second. Doesn't it say before that the people believed in God? Why did God have Sinai in order to accomplish that? They already believed in God. It says so right in the Bible. Okay? Well, the answer to that question is that Torah is not like a religion. See, a religion just tries to get people to believe certain six things which they establish, and they want the followers to just accept these things. If followers accept these things, then that's it. They're in the group, okay? They're members of the club, and that's all. That's all they want. The Torah is a religion of truth. And it's a religion of truth, and a religion of truth means that man must be functioning using his energies, his mind, his psyche, in a very active manner, essentially a very intellectual manner, okay? And you must be able to move ahead in the world of ideas. That's the emphasis of the Torah. So it's a certain kind of activity, the Torah's religion. Now, when the Torah says believe in something, okay, so belief over here means more than just accepting as something is true. The Torah is very, very cautious because the energies of the Torah recognizes that the energies of the mind are very dynamic. There's a lot of dynamics there. Let me explain what I mean. A person can accept something as true and do that thing based on the truth, but yet the mind isn't satisfied. Like, for instance, if a doctor gave you a pill and said, this pill is going to cure you, all right, you're going to accept it. It's true. I mean, he's a Harvard grad, and he's telling you this is true, a medical man, of course. But if you had bad reactions, you'd start questioning. One second, maybe something's wrong here, all right? And even if you didn't have bad reactions, in the back of your mind, there is some kind of an unsureness, but that doesn't mean you think it's not true. You obviously think, you know, it is. I have to live according to this. This is correct. But it doesn't mean you're intellectually satisfied. Now, the physician who understands the medication, he's intellectually satisfied. Not only does he know it's true, he doesn't know it's true based on authority. He knows it's true because he really understands the body and he really understands how the medicine works. Okay, two types of knowledge. One kind of knowledge tells you something is true. Both tell you something is true. But one tells you something is true, and yet you don't understand the reason. Something's bothering you in your mind. And the other one tells you it's true, but not only that, it also explains how and why it's true. Then your mind is satisfied. Okay. Now, what the Bible is teaching us is that the miracles in Egypt and the miracles of the splitting of the sea, those miracles, they were convincing. And And the people accepted that it is true. There is a God, and Moses is a servant. That's true. But in the back of their minds, there was still some kind. There was still some kind of frustration. There was something that they still were thinking. The mind was returning. In other words, when the mind's not satisfied, it may accept something, but it also is prodding to understand it more. See, the mind is still active. It's not satisfied. So God didn't want the people. They could have gone on like that, and it would also go on for generations and generations. No doubt about it. That was enough to establish the people, and that alone would have been plenty. You'd have all the miracles in Egypt and the splitting of the sea, and they would teach this to their children, and they would be able to have a Passover Seder just like we have now. Only one thing, there's only one problem. The point is that miracles, just miracles, even though you may be convinced something's true, the mind isn't satisfied. Sinai was given in order to satisfy the mind. Sinai was a different kind of miracle. There was a perceptible voice that came from the heavens that taught ideas, and this was a different kind of experience. Then there was nothing to think about. Then it wasn't just conviction, but the mind was satisfied. So you see, the Torah differentiates between two kinds of knowledge. One kind of knowledge is you may know something's true, but your mind's not satisfied. The other kind of knowledge, you know it's true, and your mind is satisfied. And God wanted the people to have not just knowledge that's true, he wanted their minds to be satisfied, because the entire Torah is a religion which engages and is very concerned about the human mind. So now, when we come back to Ecclesiastes, we can answer our question. Why does Ecclesiastes have to philosophize? If you just look at the Bible, the Torah will tell you what to do. Okay, obviously you can't understand the Torah, so you go to the rabbis, they explain to you what Torah means, and you know what to do. No problem. The answer is that if a person does something, even though he knows it's true, but if he really doesn't understand why it's true...
Rabbi, we got 1 minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
If he doesn't understand why it's true, his mind isn't satisfied. And if his mind isn't satisfied, he can't function properly. That's why Sinai was necessary. Because God wanted man to be able to function in a way that he could put all his energies into perfecting himself. And if your mind isn't satisfied, you cannot do that. That is why Ecclesiastes is necessary. That's why Solomon wrote his book, A Philosophy of Life. Okay, we'll stop it.